and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the meeting between President Trump and the North Korean dictator due to take place in 1 hour from now and explore the possibility that Kim Jong-un could put himself in the position of playing China off against the U.S. in the way that Nixon's meeting with Mao during the Cold War enabled the U.S. to play China off against the Soviet Union. A former Deputy Secretary of Defense and member of the Deputies Committee of the National Security Council, Rudy De Leon, a senior fellow with the National Security and International Policy team at the Center for American Progress, joins us to discuss how a nuclear deal with North Korea could be negotiated if the U.S. and its allies know so little about what North Korea has in terms of weapons, nuclear facilities, and delivery vehicles. We'll also assess the role of China and South Korea behind the scenes and going forward if a deal is to be struck. And since Trump has done little to no preparation compared to Nixon, we will analyze what Kim Jong-un has won so far and what he might want out of a deal which Trump appears eager to make up front without paying much attention to the details that will have to follow. Then, with Trump attacking Canada's Prime Minister again on Monday in tweets from the summit in Singapore, we will speak with Matt Gold, a professor of law who teaches international trade law at Fordham University, who held an appointment within the executive office of the president as deputy assistant trade representative for North America. He joins us to examine whether insulting close neighbors and longstanding allies could degenerate into a trade war. And while Trump is obviously playing to the Rust Belt for the midterms and 2020 and using the national security rubric against Canada to avoid input from Congress, if reciprocal tariffs start escalating in a tit-for-tat trade war, the stock market could tank and backfire on Trump. Then finally, we will look into the 5-4 decision on the Supreme Court by the conservative majority to break a bipartisan tradition and side with the Trump administration to uphold a controversial Ohio voter purge to remove voters from the rolls if they fail to vote in one election. A nationally recognized expert on election law, Richard Hassan, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine, joins us to discuss his article at Slate, Sonia Sotomayor's dissent in the big voter purge case points to how the law might still be struck down. And joining us now is Rudy De Leon, who's a senior fellow with the National Security and International Policy team at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on U.S. national security issues and U.S.-China relations. A former Deputy Secretary of Defense, he served as the Chief Operating Officer at the Pentagon, a member of the Deputies Committee of the National Security Council, and is a member of the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs National Partnership Council on Labor Management Issues. In earlier Pentagon assignments, De Leon served as Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness and as Undersecretary of the Air Force. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rudy De Leon.
Thank you, Ian.
And do you think that there's a possibility that the North Koreans could do the triangulation in the way that Nixon's meeting in Mao during the Cold War enabled the U.S. to play China off against the Soviet Union, in the sense that Kim, I believe there's no love lost between Kim Jong-un and the Chinese, and he's deeply dependent upon the Chinese, which apparently they sort of resent given their Juche policy, if that's what you could call it, of self-reliance. Is there a possibility that, in other words, I don't have a lot of faith in President Trump. I think he just wants a deal and wants to look good. But I'm interested in your opinions of what Kim Jong-un's motives might be.
Well, you're right to go directly to the China-North Korea relationship, because it's not been one of long-standing dialogue back and forth. And in fact, North Korea often behaves like the problem child to the older, bigger brother China in terms of the errant tests into the Sea of Japan and elsewhere. So there are definitely tensions. I think China, first and foremost, has always looked at North Korea as a buffer between the allied forces that are in South Korea, and has moved to prevent the regime from collapsing, because that would create large humanitarian demands on the China-North Korean border. So there's clearly, you know, they're allies, but they don't communicate with each other in a regular and systematic way. So that's one of the wild cards.
Go ahead.
Remember when Nixon went to China, Kissinger had gone in July of 1971. That was the secret trip. And then when it was announced that Nixon would go at the start of the next year, Nixon spent 6 months preparing for that summit. He had had roundtables with all of the experts, and he actually dictated to himself six briefing papers based on these discussions. And he took those six briefing papers with him. Rather than taking a large entourage, he took Kissinger and he took the Secretary of State, Bill Rogers, and a very capable interpreter, Winston Lord. But, you know, Nixon spent the time not in large staff gaggles, but instead going through the briefs that he had written. I think we can be assured that there's been no process of absorbing a lot of expertise and writing briefing memos to himself. So I think our expectations for the summit that will actually begin in 1 hour are modest at this point.
So I understand China, the buffer, they don't want the U.S. on the Yellow River. Last time that happened, the Chinese ended the Korean War, and that the Chinese, on the other hand, may be alarmed by the North Korean nuclear program because it's bringing more U.S. military assets into the neighborhood when they would like to diminish U.S. military presence in the neighborhood. So what do you think's going on? I reiterate that I'm nervous about Trump making any kind of deal to make himself look good, and he's already displayed the most bizarre behavior at the G7, which would lead any interlocutor to wonder whether you could make a deal with this guy. But I assume that Kim is serious, and I assume that the South Koreans are serious. So
I think,
go ahead.
Yep. So I think President Moon is very serious, and he used the Winter Olympic Games as the pause button in terms of the tensions and rising dialogue that was building between Washington and Pyongyang. So President Moon has been very vigorous and straightforward in terms of working this issue and has a lot to show for it. If we look at tomorrow, the preview of tomorrow's schedule, you know, there's a one-on-one meeting early in the morning. There's a plenary lunch of both sides, and then there's a press conference, and then the expectation that Air Force One will take off at 5 o'clock in the morning Eastern time and start coming back to Washington. So unlike all of the prep that went into Nixon's meeting with Mao Zedong in February 1972, this meeting will, if best, try to start a process where if there's agreement on what a dialogue would look like, you'd start to have your experts come in. Usually, the senior leaders close the session. This one looks more like a reality TV show that's going to open the session.
And again, I'm speaking with Rudy DeLeon, who's a senior fellow with the National Security and International Policy Team at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on U.S. national security issues and U.S.-China relations. A former Deputy Secretary of Defense, he served as the Chief Operating Officer at the Pentagon, a member of the Deputies Committee of the National Security Council, and in earlier Pentagon assignments, he served as Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness and as Undersecretary of the Air Force. So in terms of substance as opposed to reality TV, first of all, we don't know where all the nuclear weapons are in North Korea and their facilities as well that produce them. I mean, Sig Heck has visited them a number of times, but I don't imagine he's seen everything. So how do you have a nuclear disarmament regime when you're not sure what the other side has? How do you start that process?
Well, you start it slowly. And in fact, you know, previous administrations have tried to walk down this path with North Korea, only to find that after carrots, usually in the form of food and medical assistance, had, you know, gone to the North Korean army instead of to the people. So you have to start with an understanding of what each side will agree to. And it's not one question in terms of the North Korean nuclear program. It's the location of their reactors. It's where they're processing fuel for weapons, to close the test facilities, to halt and identify where the ballistic missiles are located, and to provide complete inspection anywhere that are part of dismantling a nuclear arsenal. So it's not one set of questions. It's a whole baker's dozen almost. And, you know, there has not really been a dialogue to this point. So thus, the most optimistic assessment for tomorrow will be that more formal detailed talks will begin between the two sides, that is the U.S. and North Korea, on nuclear disarmament. We might also see tomorrow an agreement that North Korea and South Korea will engage in earnest talks to change the armistice that has existed since President Eisenhower came to office in 1953, and to change the status of an armistice to an actual peace agreement. That would have to be negotiated between the North and the South.
Well, that's something that I think where the substance lies. I'm not sure at this point when the president says, you know, I'll know in 5 seconds or 10 seconds or a minute or whatever, whether this is going to work out. It just doesn't have a ring of seriousness to it, this meeting. But one assumes that the follow-on, the Chinese are going to weigh in, the South Koreans are going to weigh in. And it processes. I mean, Pompeo has not done nothing like the prep that was done by Kissinger before Nixon got there, but still some prep has been done. Mm-hmm. What about, though, the ultimate motive of Kim Jong-un? How do you figure that out? Because he runs a brutal family kleptocracy that basically indoctrinates people from cradle to grave with loyalty. The only political similarity you could find would be Imperial Japan in the 1930s with emperor worship. The idea that they're communists always seemed to me to be an inadequate definition or description. So why would this guy risk basically pricking the bubble of delusion that he and his regime and his parents and grandparents have created to let the North Korean people know how the rest of the world is? I mean, he'd have to really improve their standard of living fast, and somehow they'd have to be grateful for what he's done. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily how things work out.
Well, remember that Kim Jong-un is doing something that his father and grandfather wanted, which is a direct one-on-one negotiation with the United States. In prior administrations, it's been the regional parties that have always, the six-party talks, that have always been the forum for dialogue. So Kim gets his summit meeting that he's wanted. Second, you know, this is not a trustworthy regime. This is not a regime that necessarily wants to see the betterment of its people materially and economically. And so this comes down to, you know, we're going to have to be hard-nosed and very detailed in these discussions. At the same time, the fact that this is occurring and that the belligerency of the rhetoric between both sides has dramatically calmed thanks to President Moon's initiatives, again, at the time of the Winter Olympics, that's a plus. I think, just as you noted, China is very worried about North Korea. One of the responses to the continued aggressive nature of the North Korean missile tests was that Japan would likely have to invest much more in terms of its own defensive capabilities, anti-missile programs. Remember, China has almost severed its dialogue with South Korea when South Korea announced it was going to expand its high-altitude air defenses to deal with the North Korean threat. So this is a very tense region that, as long as those missile tests were occurring, was only seeing more tension. So the fact that we've got a dialogue going is constructive But we've been, as I noted, down this path twice before with not a lot to show in terms of North Korea's sincerity or commitment to following through on a process.
So you think, in effect, we'll have less tension, maybe some kind of end of the Korean War, formal end of the Korean War, but not any radical change in terms of the regime? Because, again, these kind of regimes like Assad, Assad's being prepared to destroy his country in order to continue the family rule. I imagine that also applies to the Kim family.
Well, as I note, this has to be step by step. And this is not going to be settled with a handshake or expressions of goodwill. It's going to be a lot of detailed work on inspection and dismantlement and identification of inventories.
Well, Rudy Leon, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much to all of your listeners.
And I've been speaking with Rudy De Leon, who's a senior fellow with the National Security and International Policy team at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on U.S. national security issues and U.S.-China relations. A former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, he served as the Chief Operating Officer at the Pentagon, a member of the Deputies Committee on the National Security Council, and in early Pentagon assignments served as Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness and as Undersecretary of the Air Force. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into how, if reciprocal tariffs start escalating in a tit-for-tat trade war, the stock market could tank and backfire on Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Matt Gold, a professor of law at Fordham University, where he teaches international trade law. He frequently consults with U.S. business on the negotiations of NAFTA and other U.S. trade agreements and has been consulted by the White House, National Security Council staff, State Department, and members of Congress on issues at the intersection of trade and national security. He previously held an appointment within the Executive Office of the President as Deputy Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for North America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Gold.
Great to be here.
Well, thank you, Matt. And what do you make of President Trump's tweets today from the summit in Singapore, where he's still attacking Prime Minister Trudeau of Canada? He's almost like a dog with a bone.
Well, President Trump clearly feels like he was stabbed in the back by something Prime Minister Trudeau said or did, though it's not clear to the general public what Prime Minister Trudeau did that would have been a stab in the back.
Well, he's Larry Kudlow and Peter Navarro, his aides, have gone public. And in doing so, one of them said Navarro said there's a place in hell for the Canadian Prime Minister. And the other person, Larry Kudlow, used that phrase, stab in the back, and talked about it being a betrayal. And that in itself is unusual, is it not, for government officials to attack the leader of a foreign country, or particularly a neighbor and an ally?
It is unusual. To be fair to Peter Navarro, whom I think is not competent to do his job, but still to be fair to him, I believe what he said is that there was a special place in hell for foreign leaders who act or negotiate in bad faith to the United States. I don't believe he named Prime Minister Trudeau, though it was clear he was talking about Prime Minister Trudeau. But again, specifically what Trudeau did or failed to do, or specifically what Trudeau promised or committed to do and then backed out of, is still not clear to anyone. No one seems to know what that is. There is the White House team is referencing right now President Trump's demand for what we call a five-year sunset provision to be put into NAFTA through the NAFTA renegotiation. This is a demand Trump has had from the beginning. It was a demand that Trump never, ever had any possibility of getting from Canada or Mexico. And it's one of several large demands, none of which they're going to get in a NAFTA renegotiation. They didn't actually say that Trudeau committed to the five-year sunset provision and then backed out. They just referenced the five-year sunset provision in the context of all of this noise.
Well, my understanding is that what the U.S. wants out of this changing NAFTA is they want to renegotiate the dispute settlement part of it. Is that your understanding?
Well, there's about 50 to 70 or 80 items on the U.S. wish list for the NAFTA renegotiation, depending on how you count them. And there were several from the beginning that we knew we were going to get. We got agreement in principle on those in the very beginning, and the negotiators have been banging out the details of those for all the months since the renegotiation kicked off in August, and they pretty much got that done by the end of April, early May. But there were many things on that list. Pretty much all of the large demands by the United States and many of the small ones were items that there were not agreement on principle at the beginning. The United States was never going to get them, and we still haven't. The big items that the United States demanded that we were never going to get was included, number one, the five-year sunset provision. Number two, the elimination of Chapter 19 of NAFTA, which is what you're referring to. That's a special provision that says when the U.S. government imposes anti-dumping duties and countervailing duties, which are special temporary types of customs duties, on Canadian goods or Mexican goods, if the U.S. importer who pays those duties wants to appeal that to a U.S. federal court, there's an alternate route of appeal to a U.S.-Canada binational panel or a U.S.-Mexico binational panel. So these binational panels will stand in the shoes of the American federal court in reviewing whether a U.S. government agency properly followed a U.S. statute in assessing a customs duty, which technically is assessed on the U.S. importer. It's a little bit bizarre to have a binational panel that includes foreigners making that decision. It normally would be a U.S. federal court, but the U.S. agreed to that when we originally negotiated NAFTA. There was a small chance at the very beginning that Canada might have given that up, but since that time, a couple of things have changed. Big facts on the grounds have changed. We've imposed new anti-dumping countervailing duties on Canadian lumber, and we nearly imposed new anti-dumping countervailing duties on Canadian aircraft. And those two cases, for a whole series of reasons, ended any possibility the Canadians were going to agree to giving up Chapter 19. The United States also wanted Canada to drop what we call tariff rate quotas that they charge on American poultry and dairy and eggs. Those things would normally never be allowed in a free trade agreement, but Canada got a special provision for that as well 24 years ago, and they were never going to give that up either. The United States wanted a U.S. content requirement to be put into the rules of origin. These are all things that Donald Trump wanted. The United States never wanted these things before, but Trump wanted these. The United States wanted some of them, but some of these are just creations of Trump. And there was never any possibility that was going to happen. Lastly, Trump wanted an increase in North American content requirement in the NAFTA rules of origin, the automotive rules, up to 85%. That was never going to happen, although a small increase was always possible. So those are the big things that Trump wanted. He was never going to get any of them, and he never did.
But I was actually interested, though, in talking to you about, Matt, about the ISDS, that's the Investor-State Dispute Settlement, because that appears to be an issue, is it not? And the ISDS mechanism makes it possible for companies to attempt to declare any new environmental protection unlawful. And I take it that President Trump is also taking a different position on that.
You know, ISDS is a different kind of issue because there are Americans on both sides of that issue and there are Canadians on both sides of that issue. That's not, you know, in America wants one thing and Canada wants the other. And so it's a little trickier. And your characterization of it about environmental rules is not correct. What ISDS does is it says that, for example, if an American invests in Canada, American company makes an investment or American individual makes an investment, if the Canadian government later changes its regulation of that business sector in which the American made the investment, if they change the regulations, and if they change the regulations in a way that's intended to discriminate against the American investor. Let's say, you know, a great example is wireless telecom. If an American company goes and invests in a wireless telecom company, maybe they create a wireless telecom company in Canada. So you have maybe three or four Canadian-owned companies, and then you have an American-owned company, and they're all competing in Canada. And then the telecom regulator changes the regulations in a way that really hurts, you know, the American owned company as compared to the Canadian companies. That's when the American company has a right under ISDS to either get those regulations changed so that they're not discriminating against the American-owned competitor, or if they get put out of business, they can sue for their loss. But that only kicks in. It doesn't kick in when you impose new telecom regulations or new environmental regulations or new occupational safety and health regulations, unless those regulations are discriminating against a company that's owned by this foreign investor. So this would apply for Canadian investors in the United States. It would apply for American investors in Canada. Either way, the country, when they engage in new regulation, it has to be done in a non-discriminatory way. It has to be a regulation that it really serves a public purpose and is not discriminating. It's not just there to put out of business the company that's owned by the foreigner and help the companies that are owned by the domestic owners.
But it's my understanding, though, that Canada has been on the receiving end of a whole bunch of suits, primarily from U.S. investors, and 63% of these claims against Canada involve challenges to environmental protection or resource management programs, and that supposedly interfered with the rights of foreign investors. And the U.S. has, by the way, never lost a NAFTA investor state case, as far as I know. Is that right?
As far as I know, that's correct. There are several actions against the Canadian government and provincial governments in Canada for environmental regulations, but you've got to stop and count and see how many of those cases are successful. And I cannot tell you offhand whether cases have been successful, and if so, how many, but there are a lot of pending cases, and it's a mistake to assume those cases will be successful. Any American investor in Canada who gets hurt by a new environmental regulation can bring a case. But they're not going to win that case unless the regulation was intended to go after the American investor in particular because it was American-owned and wasn't really there a regulation for the environment. It was really a regulation to hurt the foreign-owned company, usually because it's competing against a domestically-owned company. So you shouldn't just assume that those cases are going to be successful just because they're pending.
So let's focus then on Trump's main complaint, it appears, in his tweets against Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who he's called dishonest and weak, meek and mild, etc. And he's banged away at this idea, quoting Trump's tweet, "Our tariffs are in response to his 270% on dairy." Now, my understanding is that the U.S. exports five times more dairy products to Canada than Canada exports to the United States.
That's correct. Canada's dairy sector is not similarly situated to the United States dairy sector because it's colder up there and it's rather expensive to run dairy when in an area that's very cold. Start with that. Second of all, Canada has what they call price supports for dairy. They regulate the prices. They set the prices by law higher than they would normally be if market forces were determining the prices. And anytime you artificially elevate a price of a product, you create surpluses. This is the problem. You know, price normally goes up per supply and demand, so that if you have a surplus, the price will go down, the surplus will disappear. And if you have a shortage, the price will go up and the shortage will disappear. But if the price is not moving pursuant to supply and demand, then you artificially establish a price too low, you're going to have a chronic shortage. And if you artificially set the price too high, you're going to have a chronic surplus. And so setting the prices high creates surpluses. So the way Canada manages the surpluses is by limiting how much dairy every Canadian dairy can produce and sell on the Canadian market. Well, what ends up happening is Canadian dairies are basically having knife fights with each other about, you know, who's going to get how much of that quota, you know, which Canadian dairy gets to produce how much, and that's allocated by a Canadian Dairy Association. But they're certainly not going to give up some of that quota to American dairies. So what ends up happening is they don't allow dairy to be imported because they're limiting so much how much dairy the Canadian dairies can produce and sell in the Canadian market. The last thing they want to do is have to make that even smaller because there's imported dairy coming to the Canadian market. So that's why Canada had sort of a special need to have trade barriers to American dairy when we were negotiating the original NAFTA. And we agreed, whether it was smart or not to agree to it, back when we had the leverage 24 years ago, maybe to prevent this, we agreed to have these trade barriers known as tariff rate quotas, which are sort of a blend of tariffs and quotas, on actually poultry, eggs, and the dairy products that existed at that time, which were traditional, what we now call traditional dairy products, milk and cheese and butter and so on. But there are certain modern dairy products that didn't exist then, like ultra-filtered milk. And so Canada does not have the right to impose tariff rate quotas on American ultra-filtered milk because they didn't get that right 24 years ago because ultra-filtered milk didn't exist. So American dairy still exports to Canada, but they convert their dairy to ultra-filtered milk rather than exporting it as cheese or milk or whatever. So that's why we do have exports to Canada. And what happened about a year ago, actually 2 years ago, what happened in the summer of 2016, when Donald Trump had just been nominated for the presidency, is Canada then came along with this new pricing system that's too complex to explain that really made it impossible for us to sell ultra-filtered milk in Canada as well, and that was a new bomb they dropped on us. I think I've always thought we had a chance of solving the ultra-filtered milk problem, but we're never going to get Canada to give up their right to impose tariff rate quotas on the traditional dairy products or the poultry and eggs in this negotiation. We simply don't have the leverage for it.
But it's my understanding that American dairy producers wouldn't mind having the Canadian system. Is that true? That aren't there lots of suicides and bankruptcies in the U.S. dairy sector?
You know, it's very rare for a market-oriented developed economy to have price supports anymore in any sector. They're very, very problematic. You know, as I mentioned, anytime a government artificially sets a price higher than the market would normally create it, you have this huge problem with surpluses, and every time you set one too low, you have this huge problem with shortages. So, you know, market-oriented economies in developed countries just don't do it. For Canada, it's left over from an earlier era, and Canadians really need to let it go themselves. And America certainly isn't going to go backwards and do something like that, which we haven't done in a very long time.
So just turning then in the last couple of minutes, Matt Gold, to the broader picture, Donald Trump, as he was leaving the G7 in Quebec, he said, you know, it'd be better if we just got rid of tariffs altogether. Well, you know, nobody would essentially disagree with that, but that flies in the face of the main actions that he's taken. He's, for example, the TPP, which he canceled right out of the gate, and then the EU free trade agreement, which he pulled out of. They would have reduced tariffs enormously. So it just feels like Trump is talking out of both sides of his mouth.
Well, first of all, the United States and Canada have eliminated almost all tariffs between them. That's because we have a free trade agreement, NAFTA. That eliminates almost all the ordinary customs duties. It's these special temporary duties like the anti-dumping duties and countervailing duties that we still have, which are relatively, they're in very few products you know, almost all the duties have already been eliminated. But, you know, Canada carved out an exception for these tariffs on the poultry, dairy, and eggs. And so we don't have the leverage to get them to let that go. When Trump says, well, why don't we just get rid of everything? Well, you know, the United States has given up, you know, if we gave up everything, then Canada would lose that exemption that they got. And, you know, we just don't have the leverage to get Canada to agree to that. We would have had that leverage had we stayed in the TPP. But Donald Trump pulled the United States out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement on his first full business day in office, not even beginning to comprehend the implications of what he was doing. And one of the things he was doing was throwing away all the leverage that we had with Canada and Mexico in a possible NAFTA renegotiation, which is why we now don't have the leverage to get those things I mentioned earlier.
So, and what about the European deal? Would that have also reduced tariffs, would it not?
Yeah,
I mean, he's about to impose tariffs, isn't he, on automobiles, et cetera? And that's the threat.
Yeah. Well, you've got to keep everything separate in your head. What we call ordinary customs duties, which are the customs duties listed in the tariff schedule, your ordinary customs duties, those are eliminated completely in both directions on every product, are almost every product when you enter into a free trade agreement. The United States has free trade agreements with 20 other countries. And then you only have those temporary special customs duties. So that's typically done in any free trade agreement, and what we were negotiating with Europe called TTIP was going to be a free trade agreement. The Trans-Pacific Partnership was going to be a free trade agreement with 11 other countries, some of whom we already had smaller free trade agreements, some of which we didn't. These new tariffs on steel and aluminum, that's a special temporary customs duty which would apply whether you had a free trade agreement or not, and the anti-dumping and the countervailing duty is the same.
So is there a way forward, given that the president seems to be playing domestic politics for re-election politics? He's appealing to the Rust Belt. Obviously, there'll be other sectors in the U.S. that will oppose what he's doing, and he's using the national security rubric, which is what Trudeau talked about, and which apparently got him into trouble. He's using the national security rubric simply because that's a mechanism to avoid having to deal with the Congress, who may be opposed to what he's doing. So the politics of this seem to be dictating what's happening. What's your sense?
Yes, any president at this point in his presidency is very focused on the midterm elections and on re-election. Donald Trump, even more so, I think, than most presidents. For one thing, whether he can maintain control of the House and the Senate might determine whether he faces impeachment proceedings, depending on what's in the Mueller report when it comes out. So he's focused on that. If the Mueller report includes impeachable offenses, which it might or might not, but if it does, President Trump is going to want to continue to control the House and the Senate to insulate himself against an impeachment process. So he's, I think, even more focused on these midterm elections than presidents normally are, though presidents are normally very focused on midterms. And I think, of course, he's very focused on his reelection, as all presidents are. And at this point, in terms of his trade moves, despite the real damage to the U.S. economy that his trade moves are creating, and despite the real risks to our national security that he's creating when he alienates so many of our friends and allies and trading partners, I think the only moves in trade that are going to hurt him in those political contexts are moves which could impact the stock market. If he really gets into a downward spiral of retaliation for retaliation in the trade front and a trade war, it could affect the market, and that's the only way that this is going to hurt him significantly in a political way.
Well, Matt Gold, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Matt Gold. He's a professor of law at Fordham University, where he teaches international trade law. He frequently consults with U.S. business on the renegotiation of NAFTA and other U.S. trade agreements, and has been consulted by the White House, National Security Council staff, State Department, and members of Congress on issues at the intersection of trade and national security. And he previously held an appointment within the Executive Office of the President as Deputy Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for North America. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the 5-4 decision on the Supreme Court to uphold a controversial Ohio voter purge to remove voters from the rolls if they fail to vote in one election. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Richard Hassan, who's the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He is a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation, and is co-author of a leading casebook on election law. His latest book is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown, and he has an article at Slate, Sonia Sotomayor's Dissent in the Big Voter Purge Case Points to How the Law Might Still Be Struck Down. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Hassan.
Thank you for having me.
And before we get to the silver lining, let's deal with the dark cloud here. Today, Monday, the Supreme Court upheld a controversial Ohio voter purge law, which means now that states can begin to remove voters from rolls based upon their failure to vote in just one election. I think your article predicts that a lot of Republican states will follow suit and adopt Ohio's procedures, will they not?
Well, they may. I think we'll have to see. There have been a lot of improvements in voter data information sharing across states since Ohio implemented its decision. And so there's a chance that some states won't do it. I should just point out that it's not as though Ohio simply removes voters for failing to vote in one election. It's that the failing to vote in one election can start a process by which the voter can be removed, which involves sending the voter a postcard, and if the voter doesn't respond, waiting a couple of more elections and then removing the voter. So it's a combination of not voting and not responding to a postcard that leads to the purge of a particular voter's name.
But why do this in the first place? The problem in this country is not enough people vote, and it's the most difficult country in the world to vote.
So most other countries have a national registry of voters. And so you're in there for life, and you just change your address as you move, but you stay registered. In the United States, we don't have anything like that. We do voter registration on the state and county level. And when people move, or when people die, there has to be some process to remove them from the voter rolls so that the voter rolls are accurate. You don't want to have a set of voter rolls where someone goes to the polling place and there's names of dozens of people who are no longer alive or no longer in the jurisdiction. So we need to have some process to keep the voting rolls clean. How you do that process, the details, really determines how bad this kind of purging can be. If you use rules to purge that make it very easy to remove voter names, you run the risk of disenfranchising eligible voters. And I think that was one of the main questions about the Ohio system is it going to remove eligible voters? And if so, is that going to have some kind of disparate impact on certain kinds of voters? That wasn't the direct question in today's case, but that seems to me to be really what's underlying the feelings of discontent on the Democratic side about today's ruling.
And their fear is that this is going to adversely or disproportionately affect minorities, low-income voters, and veterans. And again, even if this case wasn't argued along partisan grounds, the appearance is a partisan vote. How do you see it?
Well, certainly on the Supreme Court, all of the conservatives sided with Ohio, and all of the liberals sided with the voting rights plaintiffs. So I certainly think that on the Supreme Court itself, we saw this kind of divide. I think on the statutory question of whether or not what Ohio is doing is allowed under federal law, I think that's a really close question. And I think there are good arguments on both sides, both the arguments made by Justice Alito and the arguments made by Justice Breyer in his dissent. So, how do you decide a case like that when it's really close? Well, Justice Sotomayor in her dissent says you should look at the purpose of the statute, and the purpose of the statute was a federal law designed to prevent states from making it too easy to remove eligible voters from the rolls. And she thought that should be the tiebreaker. Even though the case really wasn't litigated as a discrimination case, she thought that was important. And so I suggest in the Slate piece that you mentioned, that it might be worth the plaintiffs making another run and arguing that this law violates another provision of the National Voter Registration Act of 1993, which says that these laws have to be put in place and work in a non-discriminatory fashion. And it seems to me that, that's really an open question. One of the pieces of data that Justice Sotomayor cited was a statistic out of Hamilton County, Ohio, where African-American voters were more than twice as likely as white voters to have been removed from the rolls through this process.
And again, I'm speaking with Richard Hassan, who's a Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He is a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation and is the co-author of a leading casebook on election law. And his latest book is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. And he has an article at Slate, Sonia Sotomayor's Dissent in the Big Voter Purge Case Points to How the Law Might Still Be Struck Down. And the law that you referred to, now, of course, Sonia Sotomayor's dissent was a separate dissent from the main dissent by Breyer, right?
That's right. So Sotomayor joined in Breyer's dissent. It was a 5-4 decision, the 5 conservatives against the 4 liberals. But Sotomayor added an additional point just for herself. Breyer's dissent was focused really on the statutory question of whether the National Voter Registration Act, more commonly known as the Motor Voter Law, and the Help America Vote Act, which was a law that was passed in 2002 after the 2000 Florida election debacle, how those laws should be read in terms of what's allowed by the states when they decide to clean up their voting rolls. Very technical, very complex, and it was really Justice Sotomayor who I think was the only one who really acknowledged what was really at stake here, which is the question of if you are a person who is poor, if you're homeless, if you're a veteran, if you're a minority voter, you're much less likely to be getting that mail, returning that piece of mail. It's likely to have a discriminatory impact on who is going to be registered. And there were lots of people who have been removed from the registration rolls who fit into these categories. And this is, of course, a category of voters who are likely to vote for Democrats, which makes everybody think that this could have a political impact as well.
So I've never understood why. I mean, you say that because it goes back to the founding of the Republic, the first 13 states to join the United States, that was one of their insistences, wasn't it, that they control the elections? And it's been that way ever since. So there's no way to have a kind of a voter ID card like they do, for example, next door in Mexico, that you're on the rolls for life, as you are in most countries, when you turn 18. I mean, there are laws out there, or at least laws being proffered in certain states, that when you turn 18, you automatically get registered. And that's how it operates in lots of democracies. So is there no way? I mean,
there is a way, sure. It's a political problem, not a legal problem. The Constitution gives Congress, at least for congressional elections, for the federal elections, the power to set the rules for the time, place, and manner of voting. And it is that very authority that gave Congress the power under the Motor Voter Law and under the Help America Vote Act to set out these rules for when voter purges are allowed and when they're not allowed. So I think nothing would prevent Congress from setting up a national voter registration system, requiring people to sign up if they want to vote through this national system, have a national voter ID card if they want to. I think all of these things would be permissible. What would not be permissible would be for Congress to tell the states what the qualifications for voters should be. That's something that the Constitution gives to the states. But you could still have this kind of system in place, collect the relevant data, and let people be registered for life. We just, as you mentioned, have had this long history of decentralized election administration. And so it's a political non-starter, especially among Republicans, to talk about a greater federal role in our elections. This is seen as infringing on the power of states, even though it's quite clear to me that Congress could do this if there were the political will to do so.
But it seems to have gotten worse in terms of voter suppression as opposed to more enfranchisement. Under the Trump administration, as you point out in your article at Slate, Richard Hassan, Sotomayor's dissent in the Big Voter Purge case points to how the law might still be struck down. You point out that the federal government has long held that laws like Ohio's were illegal. Of course, the Supreme Court just ruled to make them legal. And this is a position the Trump administration reversed when it took Ohio's side in the Supreme Court. So that's an important step of how we got to this position, surely.
That's right. And it's we've seen, this is a much broader topic than this particular case that we're talking about, but we've seen in case after case the Trump administration, Department of Justice, changing longstanding policies. And this particular one, about how to read what kind of purges are allowed under federal law. The old interpretation, which was rejected today, was one that both Democratic and Republican administrations had agreed upon. So George W. Bush and Barack Obama agreed that the law should be read this way. The Trump administration came to the Supreme Court, switched sides, and here we are. And, you know, looking over to the next few weeks, we're going to see a Texas voting rights, a voter redistricting case that's coming up. And that's another case where you've seen the Trump DOJ switch sides, first siding with voting rights plaintiffs, now siding with the states in ways that I think benefit the Republican Party.
But the five conservative justices on the Supreme Court didn't appear to be bothered by the fact that federal governments have long held that laws like Ohio's were illegal. And this is a position that, as you point out, was taken by both Obama and by George W. Bush. So there's a difference there, is there not, between Republican presidents, or tradition, if that's the right word, and the attitudes of these five conservative justices?
Right. Well, I think the conservative justices, as well as many of the liberal justices, looked at this question as a matter of trying to understand what the words mean in the context of the statutes without looking at the bigger picture. And if I'm right that it's a close call, it's not surprising that Republican justices who hear messages from Fox News or conservative media tend to view these things differently than liberal justices who tend to hear things from MSNBC and liberal media. And so I think we can't think of these justices as operating in some kind of vacuum where they don't get the same messages. You know, Democrats hearing that there's a lot of voter suppression, Republicans hearing there's a lot of voter fraud. It's a close statutory case. What your priors are likely to have a big impact on how you view the merits of something that is at least ostensibly supposed to be apart from that question.
But how could you make a case that voter fraud involved in this particular issue of the changing the law to mean that if you don't vote in a single election in this country, and at least in the state of Ohio, and other Republican states are likely to follow now that the Supreme Court has ratified this, once you have this situation across the country, I mean, as you pointed out earlier, just because you failed to vote in one single election doesn't automatically mean you're struck from the rolls, but it begins the process to strike you from the rolls. And that's just on the surface, seems like an invitation to head in what would seem to be the wrong direction in any kind of reasonable democracy. You want people to vote. You don't want them to punish them for not voting.
Well, if you look at the very beginning, the very first paragraph of Justice Alito's majority opinion, he talks about how there are 24 million voter registrations in the United States, about 1 in 8, that are either invalid or significantly inaccurate, and about 2.75 million are said to be registered to vote in more than one state. Those are accurate figures so far as we know. But the subtext here is there's a big potential for voter fraud, and we know that these justices have said that in other cases. And so the concern is about bloat. And when there's bloat, you need to purge. That seems to be the message that the more conservative justices are putting out. This is what I mean when I say that in the background of these justices' minds is at least the potential for great voter fraud, which is why they feel the need to read the law in this way. While on the other side, it's most clear in Justice Sotomayor's dissent, is a fear about voter suppression. And, of course, Congress could fix this problem tomorrow by rewriting the statute and making it a thumb on the scale in favor of enfranchisement. But politically, that's not going to happen, because what we've seen in this country since the 2000 election is the emergence of what I've called red state election law and blue state election law. In places like California, with lopsided Democratic majorities, you see the state passing laws that are making it easier for people to register and vote. And in states with lopsided Republican majorities in their legislatures, as in Texas or North Carolina or Wisconsin, you see laws that are making it harder for people to register and vote. And, you know, these have partisan political implications. And so if we think about Congress trying to make changes, they're not doing it in terms of a blank slate. They're doing it much more in terms of what's going to benefit their particular political party.
But when you mention the beginning of Justice Alito's opinion, where he points out how, in effect, how screwed up our voting systems are because they are decentralized, my question would be, are we trying to fix the problem or take advantage of the problem?
Well, I think that's, you know, that certainly these laws are being promoted as keeping voter registration databases accurate and ensuring against voter fraud. But like you, I suspect that some of the reason that these laws are passed and stay in place is because people see that they will gain a partisan political advantage in having a smaller electorate and an electorate that skews away from those who are likely to vote for Democrats. I think that is really the unfortunate reality of how elections are administered in the United States these days.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes here, Richard Hassan, tomorrow, Tuesday, in Maine, the voters will be able to rank candidates in a way that is quite common in lots of other countries. In Australia, it's called preferential voting, and it's been around forever, where you list your first, second, third choices, if you will. And the idea is that this helps sort of third-party candidates, and it basically ends up, it gives the voter a better opportunity to express their preferences. And, of course, the example would be that in Florida in 2000, people that voted for Ralph Nader ended up electing George W. Bush, and Al Gore was a fellow environmentalist along with Ralph Nader. So, needless to say, Gore wasn't too happy about that, and he lost the election. Just the numbers were so close. I think 535 votes separated, decided who became president, and I believe 96,000 votes went to Nader. So the idea is that you don't want to have those kind of situations and that this is a solution. So am I correct in that characterizing this new system of voting that they've just adopted in Maine, which they're going to be using tomorrow?
Well, it certainly gives people who vote for third-party candidates a chance to have a greater say in who is ultimately chosen as the candidate, because if their first-choice candidate is at the bottom of the ranking, then their vote will be allocated to their second-choice candidate. And this is also being used in San Francisco. It's being used in some other American cities. And I think we're going to see some people claim that the system is too confusing, that it might lead to some perverse outcomes. But I think a lot of people are excited about this as a potential to improve the representation in our democracy. And I was surprised to see the lead editorial in the Sunday New York Times yesterday was an endorsement of this ranked choice voting. And so it's certainly something I'm keeping my eye on to see how things develop.
Well, Richard Hassan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Richard Hassan. He's the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation, and is the co-author of a leading casebook on election law. And his latest book is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. And he has an article at Slate. Sonia Sotomayor's dissent in the big voter purge case points to how the law might still be struck down. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Marshall. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Lariva-Latt. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.